T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for QNN20K.
T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leto Sanik.
Control room, you're on the air.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. Host Len Osanek. Today we are speaking to author, noted researcher, Mr. John Armstrong. Hello, John.
Hi, Len.
It's a pleasure to have you on. You call me up in between our interviews with little tidbits now and then. I say, geez, that should have been a show. We should have just recorded that. And this morning you called me talking about a few things. And I guess I wanted to back up and say, listen, let's let people know that you have some videos out. There is on your harveyandlee.net, there are 6 new videos, and they are the Alter Dallas police transcripts. I think we talked about that last time you were on, but there's the Tippit murder part 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then the Oswald prearranged murder. And these are videos that you have put together yourself. I know myself or other people have put some of your good talks, put the visuals on. But this is something you decided to do. And I'm just going to urge everyone to go to Harvey and Lee. And it's harveyandlee.net. I'll make links to that. But do you want to tell me just quickly what was the motivation for you deciding to get into some video editing and putting the visuals beside one of your articles, the audio that was recorded?
Well, it's very simple. When I wrote my book in 2003, I did it in chronological order, and I tried to, make sure everything was in order, and what information I had was listed and noted in the back of the book and the index, and that's the way I like to do my talks, my writings, and so on. And there were several audio recordings that you and I made, and people have taken those audio recordings and added video information to those, and they're on YouTube. But they're not cohesive. They're not in order.
Or quite what you had in mind.
Yeah, not even close to what I had in mind. So I just decided to tell the story in my own way, from start to finish, if you will, and try and put in as much information as in chronological order as I could. And, you know, that starts off, it starts off with the Tippit murder. And the 1, 2, 3, and 4, the Oswald part, the Oswald Tippit part, just is my analysis of what happened from beginning to end in the Tippit shooting and the aftermath of the Oswald arrest, the second Oswald being seen outside of Mac Pate's garage, driving a red Ford Falcon to Sergeant Vinson, claiming that he rode with Oswald on a plane, a CIA plane, that landed in Dallas and then landed in Roswell, New Mexico. And the base was shut down for a while and eventually opened back up and he went home to Colorado. So, you know, in summation, that's what I wrote. But in all of my work, I try to put it in chronological order. And a lot of my work is things that I have known about for years, 20 years, sometimes more, sometimes longer. And so when I put all of this information in, a lot of people, a lot of researchers have not heard of some of this information. For example, I have known for a long time that Oswald met at the Luna Cafe, Mexico City, with a fellow, and he called himself Alex with an X, Heidel. And then we know that Oswald in Russia, he called himself Alec with a K. So I've known that for years. I just never thought that it was, you know, that significant to bring out. But when you've got two people using the name Lee Harvey Oswald, and you've got one fellow, Lee in this case, using the identity of Alex, and when you've got Harvey using the identity of Alec with a K, then that takes on, at least for me, some significance. And you can separate those two. Anyway, that's just one small part of information that I've known for a long time and have just shared it in the video that I did recently.
Well, also, you know, you did the altered Dallas police transcripts, and you may have known some of that, but until you actually bring that to the community and say, listen, everyone who's interested, this is what happened. I mean, this is like right in the Dallas, you know, in the nest of the hornet's nest there, the belly of the beast, whatever. There's fraud going on there. I mean, that was astounding.
What happens is people have said for a long time that there were four different police transcripts given to the Warren Commission. Well, that's not true. There were four transcripts, but two transcripts were given. One was 2 pages long, and the other was 4 or 5 pages long. Those brief, very, very brief transcripts were just bits and pieces of information from the original police transcripts that were given to Jesse Curry. And then the actual police transcript, which was prepared by Bowles of the Dallas Police Department, those were given first to the Secret Service. I believe it was on the 29th of... It was either November or December. I'm sorry, I can't remember which date it was. I thought it was on, it doesn't matter. Well, yeah, the four Dallas police transcripts, like I said, there were four, but two of them were just very, very small. One was 2 pages, one was, I think, 4 or 5 pages. Those were written to Jesse Curry. The original Dallas police transcript was written by Bowles of the Dallas police. He worked for the Dallas Police Department and head of communications. So if you look back at it, there were only three Dallas police transcripts. The fourth transcript, which was the one that people always look to, was created by the FBI. And what people don't realize about that transcript is, I mean, they just take it and they just assume for some reason that that's the authentic, genuine thing. And what people need to understand is the Warren Report was printed and in President Johnson's hands in September, the last of September. Now, this FBI transcript was prepared by the FBI and then redone, changed and redone with the timing of the shooting. But it was not given to the Warren Commission until August, 1 month before the Warren Report was done. In other words, the Warren Commission would have no chance to review that, look at it, comment on it, agree or disagree with it. They were just, that was it. I believe that Hoover did that intentionally. In other words, he withheld that report, the FBI report, the transcript, until the last minute, knowing that the Warren Commission would not have any chance to, you know, debate it or correct it or anything like that. And that is a huge thing. But researchers, people, book writers, authors, that's what they look at when they piece together the timing of the Tippit murder. And that, in my view, is a fabrication of the time of the murder. In order to, you know, pin down the time of the murder, you just need to look at the testimony, the documents, starting with the ambulance driver, Jason Butler. He said, he left, showed up at the scene. He said he was there less than a minute and then straight to the hospital, which is about a minute and a half, 2 minutes. And they took Tippit out of the ambulance into the emergency room. Doctor looked at him, checked him over, pronounced him dead at 1:15. But, you know, the Warren Commission says that he was shot at 1:15. So something's very, very wrong there. Then you back up and you look at Domingo Benavides' testimony, who says that after Oswald ran around the corner house, which was Virginia Davis's house, where Scoggins was parked in his taxi, he said he got out of his truck, went over and tried to use the police radio in Tippett's car to call the dispatcher. And very clearly on the Dallas tapes, the original Dallas tapes, those are called out at 1:10. So the FBI changed the transcript to make it look like it was police that were calling instead of car 10, which was Tippett's car. That's total fabrication. And you got Boley that looked at his watch and said it was 1:10. You got Helen Markham that was going to catch a bus. She thought it was 1:06. And all add them up together, it's clear what happened. The FBI simply changed the timing of the Tippett murder. It's all in black and white. And, you know, for example, how many people have read those transcripts carefully enough to know that there were 3 ambulances dispatched to the Tippett murder scene? I've never, since I've been looking into the JFK matter, I've never heard any author, any researcher, any person, anytime, anywhere, say there were 3 ambulances dispatched. But there they are, right in the Dallas police tapes, transcripts, and they're also in the FBI transcripts. So, you know, I don't understand why people have not simply gone back to the original document, the original Dallas police tapes, and compared them with the FBI transcripts. That's all I did. Just put one document on the left, one document on the right, and just read down. So, you know, a lot of these things, to me, are just side by side. They're kind of simple to understand. Just put them down side by side and see what you've got.
It could be that people never dreamed they would be different. They just kind of glossed over it and thought, well, there can't be anything there. And yet, when it took you to do that and go through the different codes that say, you know, one ambulance has already been called, but they can turn around now because there's another guy there already. It's really impressive that you found all these things, if you ask me.
Well, 2 of the ambulances showed up at the same time. You have to look at the codes. I'm sorry, I can't remember the codes right now. They're in the write-up. But one of the codes, it may be 605. There's a code for en route. Maybe that's 602. I'm not sure. Can't remember. And then there's a code when they arrive at the scene. I believe that's 605. And 2 of the ambulances reported to the dispatcher, code C, ambulance such and such, code 605. So, but what is curious is why none of the witnesses mentioned anything about 2 ambulances. I mean, look, Virginia Davis, Helen Markham, Benavides, Croy, Sergeant Croy, nobody mentioned 2 ambulances or 3 ambulances. In fact, Jason Butler didn't mention 3 ambulances. He just loaded Tippett's body in the ambulance and drove to the hospital. But when you look at these things and you start to compare, well, one of the things I noticed is Rankin. Rankin wrote an email, not email, sorry, wrote a letter to Hoover and said, hey, there's a problem in the transcript that you sent us showing 1:10. And obviously something's wrong because, you know, you say the shooting happened at 1:15. So could you please review this and, you know, make the necessary corrections? And that's when Hoover realized there was a problem with it. In my view, that's when Hoover realized there was a problem with the timing. In other words, the original Dallas police transcript showed 1:10, but apparently nobody looked that over. And here they were, FBI just said, okay, it's 1:15. And in my view, Rankin was the first person to spot that and then contact the FBI. And the FBI knew they had a problem And that was in, I believe that was in June when Rankin wrote that letter to the FBI. And then Rankin, in my view, didn't trust the FBI because he asked the Secret Service in Dallas to contact the Dallas Police Department and see if he could get an original transcript directly from the Dallas Police. Well, the Secret Service never contacted them, and so he was forced to go back to Hoover and say, can you give us an original police transcript? And then when Hoover finally sent the transcript to the Warren Commission, their job was basically over because the book was about to be started in the, you know, the printing presses in the government printing office. When Hoover sent that, his last typewritten transcript to the Warren Commission in August. So you just lay these things out, you know, in chronological order, side by side. I mean, it's not that difficult to understand.
Well, one thing I find, go ahead.
Well, Len, it's like, you know, one of the first things I did, I went to Jim Mars's class 1991, I think it was, when the JFK, just after the JFK movie came out. And, you know, I started reading the Warren volumes, and I came across, you know, all kinds of things, different eye color, different height, different weight. Okay, fine. You know, people make mistakes. And then I came across this Warren Commission Exhibit 1386, which was, of course, Palmer McBride. And Palmer McBride, you know, he was an airman first class. He was at Cape Canaveral at that time. And he told his security officer that he knew Oswald. He worked with Lee Oswald in 1957 and 58 at the Pfisterer Dental Laboratory in New Orleans from the fall of 1957 through the late spring of 1958. Well, okay. And then I just, when was Oswald in the Marines? So I got out his Marine history and I put them side by side. I said, wait a minute. Oswald was in Japan in 57 and 58. What's McBride talking about working with Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans for 8 months? And that's what got me started on, you know, the two Oswald thing. And from that point, I went backwards, went forwards, and you know, things just all I have done is put documents side by side by side. For example, Robert Oswald said in his Warren Commission testimony, well, he went to Stripling Junior High School. What? Stripling, his brother. Well, he couldn't have because he went to junior high seventh and half of the eighth grade in New York City, and Beauregard for the, you know, last half of the eighth and ninth, graduated from Beauregard Junior High School in New Orleans. So, you know, I called the principal at Stripling, and he said, yeah, Oswald went here. I said, well, how do you know that? And he says, everybody knows it. Well, are there any teachers there that, you know, still teaching that we're teaching in 1954? No. So, he told me to go down to, you know, the Fort Worth School District. So I did. And I got a list of all the teachers that were teaching at Stripling Junior High in 1954. And I started calling them. And everybody said, the one you need to talk to is Mr. Cudlady. He was the assistant principal. Oh, okay. So I called Mr. Cudlady at home. I didn't know the man. I knew that he was a PhD. He was then head of the Waco School District, the entire school district for the Waco area, Waco, Texas. And he answered the phone, and I said, hi. I introduced myself, told him I was a JFK researcher. And I said, you used to teach at Stripling Junior High. He says, yes, many years. I said, did Lee Harvey Oswald by chance attend there? Yeah, he attended there. I said, how do you know that? Well, he says, I gave the FBI his school records. And I mean, I just about passed out. I couldn't believe it. That's what Frank said. He attended Stripling Junior High at the same time Lee Oswald was attending Beauregard in New Orleans. So, you know, one by one, you put these things side by side. And at first, it's hard to believe. But when you put them side by side again and again and again and again and again, Oswald in New York City, when Oswald's in Russia, for example, you know, Oswald showing up at Bolton Ford in New Orleans buying Jeeps when Oswald's in Russia. I mean, things like that don't make any sense. But those are FBI reports. So you start putting these things together, and the story tells itself. But anyway, well, there's certain things. Yeah. Well, there's certain things. There's a couple of issues, Lynn, that I have, you know, I have said it and said it and said it again and again and again, and it seems to just like skip over people's heads. And the one thing that everybody knows about is Oswald spoke Russian, and he spoke perfect Russian. If you look at George de Morenshield's testimony, George de Morenshield says that Oswald preferred reading classical Russian literature to reading English. All of the white Russians that were interviewed by the Warren Commission said his Russian was just perfect. Now, you can't drop out of the ninth grade and teach yourself Russian while you're in the military for a year and a half. You can't do it and speak perfect Russian. And when he was in Russia, I told you, I had the opportunity to meet the lady who was his next door neighbor, Anita Zeiger, in Argentina. So I flew down to Argentina and met with her. And her father was Oswald's boss at the factory in Minsk, where Oswald worked two years. And I just asked her off, you know, just kind of a side thing, how well did he speak Russian? And she looked at me like just like, what? He didn't speak any Russian. And that just, you know, I didn't know what to say. He spoke no Russian at all? Nope, not a word. My God. Because Marina is saying he spoke perfect Russian with a Baltic accent. So who do you believe? Well, I believe Anita Zeiger, his next door neighbor. Anita had a sister. She said the same thing. She's living in Florence, Italy. Anyway, my question has always been, you tell me where Oswald learned to speak perfect Russian.
Yeah, well, there's that language school, but what was that, like a month or two course?
Look. Lynn, this guy was born speaking Russian. He was a native speaking Russian boy who was brought to the United States after World War II as an orphan. That's where he learned to speak Russian. I have talked to several people. I talked to a fellow named Zach, Z-A-C-K, Zach Stout. And Zach said, look, I met Oswald the day he arrived in Japan. And I was with him on maneuvers in the Philippines, South China Sea, until he left. And then I saw him a couple of times when he was in El Toro, California. Zach was with him every single day. And I asked Zach, well, do you remember, did he have any kind of a Russian book or listening to Russian records or anything? And Zach laughed. He said, where do people get these ideas? He said, we were on maneuvers. We couldn't carry anything but our backpack. We were on landing crafts, boats, on maneuvers, setting up stations. No, he didn't have a book. He didn't carry a record player. That's silly. Didn't happen. So when Zach was with Oswald until the day he left, Zach never, he saw him at El Toro a couple of times riding a bus. Then Oswald, who's at the Santa Ana facility, not the El Toro station, which is 7 miles away. Harvey, the Russian-speaking fellow, is at the Santa Ana facility, listening to Russian records, getting Russian newspapers, and all this stuff. All of a sudden, he speaks Russian. But the people in the Marines never said a word in Japan about him doing anything. The Monterey School of Languages? Fine. You tell me the date he attended, and I'll show you the Marine Corps unit diaries that put him at a different location. And I can tell you the people that he was in the Marines with that I have talked to. I've talked to people who was with him virtually all the time in the Marines, in El Toro, Santa Ana, Japan. And, you know, the only person that spoke the Russian was the fellow at the Santa Ana facility, the radar facility, the helicopter. Look, El Toro was a jet base, had 5,000 Marines, jet airplanes. Harvey was stationed, the Russian-speaking Oswald was stationed at Santa Ana. That's a helicopter facility. It was one big Quonset hut with 400 or 500 Marines there. That was it. Two very, very different facilities. And there was one fellow, John Hart Eli, who was the youngest member of the Warren Commission. And he wrote memos to Rankin and said, look, I've got a problem here with Oswald. I talked to Sergeant Goodwin in El Toro, and he talks about Oswald being just as good a shot as he was. And he talked about a fellow named Sawchuk, Godin, and other people. And I've never run into these names before. And this was at El Toro. And then we go to Santa Ana, and everybody knew Oswald there. And he was not a good shot. And Eli wrote these memos. And what happened was, there was a memo, and it's in my website, but basically it says, a memo written to Rankin that said, there are... I'm not going to be accurate word for word, but it was something like, there are biographical details in the history of Lee Harvey Oswald and his family that are going to require material alteration and in some cases omission. Now that statement is huge. They're wanting to change Oswald's, the documented life of Oswald and his family. They're going to alter information and in some cases omit information.
Well, that just goes to show that something doesn't add up.
How about Major Gorski? Major Gorski was interviewed by the FBI, and he was the provost marshal at El Toro, the provost marshal. And he said Oswald was discharged in March of 1959. FBI report. Then you've got Oswald Harvey being discharged from the Marines in September of 1959 from Santa Ana. So, you know, lay those papers down side by side. Lynn, that's all I've done in my research. My research is not complicated at all. I mean, it's no different than, you know, you've got an Oswald that was seen getting in an ashram, you got an Oswald seen getting on a bus. Lay down the papers side by side. What have you got? You got an Oswald arrested in the balcony of the Texas Theater, taken out the back. You got an Oswald that was arrested in the lower section. Lay the papers side by side. What have you got?
Speaking of that, well, I was going to say, now when you've got two of one person, whatever, you've got these two wallets. And thank goodness that we have the video footage preserved that you can see the second wallet being found at the scene. And then you go, well, what's that? You know, his wallet there?
Well, let's go a step further. Let's go one step further. In my view, it's likely, I can't prove it, it's likely there were two pistols involved. It's likely, no question about it, there were two jackets involved, and there were two wallets involved. Now, I've said before in my write-up, and it's very important, but you know, sometimes people just gloss over it, Lenny May Randall was interviewed with the Warren Commission, and she watched Oswald through her kitchen window walk up to the house in the morning of November 22nd. She said he was wearing a dark colored jacket. And the Warren Commission showed her Commission Exhibit 163 and 162, which was the Eisenhower light-colored jacket. And she said, no, he's wearing this one, the dark-colored one. Oh. Then you look at Earlene Roberts' testimony, FBI report, he left zipping up his dark colored jacket. Okay, just for a second, let's forget the color of the jacket. He leaves the rooming house with the jacket. In the Texas Theater, he's got no jacket. Where did the jacket go? Why has nobody asked that question? Why has nobody, in all of the research, all of the books, what did Oswald do with his jacket? Because there's two jackets, and that's the problem. The problem is that the man who shot Tippit was wearing an Eisenhower-type jacket. Oswald left his rooming house wearing the dark colored jacket. Before he got to the Texas Theater, he left that jacket in the car that Westbrook and Croy were driving. And that jacket remained in car 207 when Westbrook and Croy pulled up between the two houses and watched Tippit and Oswald talking through the window of Tippett's car. And then Tippit was shot by Oswald wearing the light-colored jacket, and he takes off. Croy gets out of the car, car 207, and he's left at the scene. But he can't be wearing his police uniform. What's a policeman going to be doing at the Tippit murder scene? So in my view, he wears Oswald's jacket that Oswald left in car 207. He's wearing the jacket. Helen Markham says, "This man was standing over me. I thought he was a policeman. He had a white hat on." Well, he's wearing a jacket which covers the upper portion of his police uniform. And just before the ambulance arrives, Jason Butler arrives, Croy takes off that jacket and he puts it over Tippett's body. Because Jason Butler told the House Select Committee he pulled a dark blue jacket off of Tippett's body before they loaded Tippit into the ambulance. 3 weeks later, that jacket shows up in the Domino Room at the Texas Book Depository.
At the Domino Room, right.
So anyway, those are things to me that just fall into place and make all the sense in the world. You have to ask, if you look at Westbrook, when I first started looking at Westbrook, I couldn't believe his testimony. You walked to the book depository. You walked 1 mile to the book depository. And then when I read Croy's testimony, it was the same thing. He asked some police officers, "Do you guys need any help?" "No, I don't." That's just not even, that doesn't make any sense at all. And he wants to drive home. He wants to drive to Austin's barbecue and meet his wife for lunch on the day, the most important and the most infamous day in Dallas history. And this guy wants to go to lunch with his estranged wife. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So anyway, what you've got is Westbrook, in my view, and Croy boarding the bus that Oswald was on, looking for Oswald. But Oswald had already got off the bus and was taking a taxi. That's why Tippit, who was waiting for Oswald to drive across the Thornton Freeway Expressway, when the bus came, the Mercedes bus, and turned left, and Oswald didn't get off, Tippit knew there was a problem. So he left the Glico station, went to the Top 10 record store. He's trying to call his boss. What's going on? Oswald's not there. Westbrook and Croy know there's a problem because they didn't find Oswald on the Mercedes bus either. So Sergeant Jerry Hill and a newspaper reporter, Jim Ewell, sitting in the back seat of car 207, were driven by Jimmy Valentine from the police station to Dealey Plaza. Hill got out of the car. He opened the door. There's a picture of it. 207 is clearly on that car. And Hill goes upstairs and, you know, he's photographed sticking his head out the window with a sniper's nest. The newspaper reporter gets out of the car, and that's it. I believe that it was Croy and Westbrook that got into car 207 and drove past Oswald's house, honked the horn, picked him up at the corner, and drove him directly to the Texas Theater. And then from there, they go to the Tippit shooting. I can't prove that, but there was a police car between those two houses. And there was a police car at Earlene Roberts' house, which she said was car 207. Now, who drives car 207 if not Westbrook and Croy? Now, when Westbrook returns to the Texas Book Depository in car 207, he gets out. Tippett's just been shot two or three minutes earlier. However long it takes Westbrook to drive to race back to the book depository. 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, I don't know. He wants to be seen there when the reports come in that the police officer's been shot. And Jim Ewell hears over a police radio he's been shot. He knows Westbrook. Westbrook gets in his personal, unmarked police car, along with Sergeant Stringer. And Dallas Morning News reporter Jim Ewell asked, hey, can I ride along with you? Sure. So he gets in the back of Westbrook's car. Now, remember, Westbrook told the Warren Commission that some officer drove him to the scene of the Tippit murder. That's not true. That's a big lie. He did not go to the scene of the Tippit murder. He drove to Oak Cliff down Jefferson Boulevard. What's his name? Jim Ewell got off at McCandle's Market, called the Dallas Morning News to report where he was. Sergeant Stringer got off and started helping people search down a house that was on the corner of Patton and Jefferson. What do I think happened? I can't prove it, but I think Westbrook drove his personal car another 150 feet to Crawford Street, turned right, and in the alley behind the Texaco parking lot, I think he took that Oswald's jacket, the long jacket, and planted it underneath a 1954 Oldsmobile, because it was Westbrook that had that jacket. Westbrook told the Warren Commission he gave the jacket to some officer as he, you know, went to the Texas Theater. That's a lie. Westbrook had the jacket. Westbrook took the jacket to the police department. Westbrook filled out a report, which he signed. The jacket was not entered into evidence. Westbrook hid that jacket for the next week. That jacket was not seen for 1 week. And the reason for that is, can you imagine showing that jacket to Oswald and saying, this is your jacket? He'd scream bloody murder. So what you've got is you've got Westbrook with the jacket. You got Westbrook with a wallet. And in my view, he may, I say may, I don't know. I don't know what happened to the pistol that was used to murder Tippit. The most convenient thing would be to slip that murder weapon into Oswald's pockets as they were taking him down and arresting him. I don't know if that's what happened. I know that Gus Rose said later that he heard Oswald saying, the police planted that gun on him. That's what he said. And you've got another fellow, George Applin, who was sitting in the movie theater, and he said he first saw the gun in the hands of somebody who was wearing a short sleeve shirt. Well, Oswald was wearing a long sleeve shirt. So, you know, you've got all kinds of stories. I don't know that we'll ever know where the gun came from. It's a certainty that Oswald did not purchase that gun. He probably never touched that gun. Anyway, Westbrook, he's got a wallet. It's got the two IDs in it, the Alec and Alex IDs in that wallet. Nobody knew about that wallet. I'm sorry. Let me ask you a question, Lynn. Do you know the time that that second wallet first became public information?
No, not public information, no. But go ahead, tell me.
We're going to go from 1963, 33 years later, to 1996. Nobody knew about that second wallet until James Hostie, FBI agent Hostie, wrote about it in his book called Assignment Oswald in 1996. Now, what does that mean? That means Barrett, FBI agent Barrett, said that the last he saw the wallet was in Westbrook's hands, and Westbrook was leaving the scene of the Tippit murder. Look, Westbrook was only at the scene of the Tippit murder for 3 or 4 minutes, and then he hurried with Jim Ewell, reporter, sitting in the backseat of Westbrook's car to the Texas Theater. And it was Westbrook's car parked in front of the Texas Theater that was used to haul Oswald to the police station. Jim Ewell wrote, he said, they put Oswald in the back seat where I sat in Westbrook's car when we were arrived at the Texas Theater. But nobody said a word about Westbrook's car being the car that Oswald was driven to police headquarters in. Every one of the five officers who accompanied Oswald was asked about the car. Not one of those officers said it was Captain Westbrook's personal car. They said it was a patrol car. They said it was a car parked out front. One fellow said it was, I think, Police Unit 466, something like that. Nobody mentioned Westbrook. So what you've got is Westbrook telling all kinds of people at 10th and Patton, anybody know Alec Heidel? Anybody know Lee Harvey Oswald? You see, without that wallet, how do you connect Lee Harvey Oswald to the rifle that was ordered with the name Alec Heidel? So you've got Captain Talbert and Sergeant Owens being filmed holding the wallet, filmed by cameraman Ron Ryland, the movie footage. That movie footage, by the way, appeared on Dallas television stations that evening. I've got a picture of a TV showing that wallet. It's on my website. So then you've got Croy saying he knew about the wallet. You got Westbrook showing the wallet. And you got these Barrett, FBI agent Barrett, knows about the wallet. Go back to the police station. Captain Fritz knows about the wallet. You got a lot of people knowing about the second wallet. But that wallet was covered up for 33 years. And that wallet, in my view, could likely have changed the outcome of what we have been given from the Warren Commission. Think about it. If the media had found out there was a second wallet that appeared at the Tippit murder scene, and then a second wallet taken from Oswald when he was driven to police headquarters in the police car, you got two wallets. This guy's being framed. If the media would have got a hold of that, the public would have found out about that, then was he being framed for the murder of Tippit? And by the way, is he being framed for the murder of President Kennedy? That is a huge, huge cover-up that nobody has ever adequately written about, talked about. Every single Dallas police employee who was at 10th and Patton, Captain Talbert, Sergeant Owens, Westbrook, Captain Fritz, Croy, they all testified before the Warren Commission. Not one of them said anything about a second wallet. That's a cover-up. That's a huge cover-up. In my view, Fritz knew that second wallet was a throwdown wallet, and that's why he never asked Oswald any questions about Oswald's involvement with the Tippit shooting. He didn't ask him anything. How did you get to the 10th and Patton? Who called you over to the, which direction were you walking? Did the police officer call you over? Why did you shoot him? How did you go to the Texas Theater? Did you buy a ticket? Didn't you? I mean, he didn't ask him anything about the murder, because I think Fritz realized he was being framed.
Well, just the idea that there's two wallets is just amazing, or three, right?
No, there's two. Forget the third one. There's just two. There's just two. But the overwhelming thing is this: you've got to understand. People need to understand. This was a huge Dallas police cover-up. Not one person, not one officer, nobody said a word about the second wallet to a news reporter, to their wives, to the media, anybody. That is huge. I mean, if there's one thing that you could point to and call a smoking gun, that's the second wallet. And people have just kind of glossed over. They've kind of glossed over the second wallet like they've glossed over where Oswald, you know, learned to speak Russian in the first place. And those are two things that if you find out the true answers to both, you've broken the case wide open. Now, one more thing. 1996, Hostie's book was released in March of 1996. Now, after people read about the second wallet and Westbrook's involvement in the second wallet, I cannot imagine how many people would have tried to track down Westbrook for an interview. The problem is, 3 months before the book was released, Westbrook died in Tahlequah, Oklahoma.
It's so interesting, and you keep coming up with these items that, that really should intrigue researchers to dig deeper in, because, like you say, they had to know then that there was a setup going on, that this guy was a patsy, and that they were over their heads.
That's right. That's right. Now, let's go to a couple more. Look, they're very small incidents, but they're very huge. Captain Fritz showed Oswald the Alec James Heidel ID card. Oswald took one look at it and said, not going to discuss it. Fritz wrote a report that said Oswald admitted that was his card. Now, that's not true. FBI agent Bookout wrote a report, FBI report. The head of the Secret Service in Dallas, Forrest Sorrells, he wrote a report. And both men said when Fritz showed Oswald the ID card, Oswald refused to talk about it. But here's Fritz writing a report that said Oswald admitted it was his card. Fritz knew damn well it was a setup. And if you go one step further, just one step further, well, two steps. How much can we believe about Fritz's handwritten notes? And remember, serious-minded researchers, only serious-minded researchers, know that Fritz's handwritten notes were nowhere to be found for 15 years. And Fritz's handwritten notes first appeared and were given anonymously to the Assassination Records Review Board in 1978. How genuine are Fritz's handwritten notes? Good luck.
Well, what's your thought? Any truth to them at all?
No. Well, No, there's probably truth on. Well, for example, Fritz said to people, I asked Oswald where he got the pistol. He said, well, you know, boys just carry the pistol in the, just carry a pistol in the movie theater. I don't believe that for a second. He said, Oswald said, oh, I bought the pistol over in Fort Worth. I don't believe that for a second. Not one second. Oswald admitted the Alec Heidel cards were his. I don't believe that for a second. And see, the other thing people don't understand, look, my research is really, really simple to follow if you do it in chronological order. It's kind of like, just like I explained to you. Nobody, Fritz's notes, oh yeah, well, Fritz wrote this and Fritz wrote that. But people that say that don't know the history of Fritz's notes. They don't understand that those notes came from, who knows, an anonymous source and were given to the Assassination Records Review Boards in 1978. People don't understand that. So you've got to look at Fritz's notes and question which ones are authentic and which ones are not authentic. I don't know. I'd say certain of them were fabricated by Fritz in order to point the finger towards Oswald.
And then keep the FBI happy, right?
If you go the second step, if Fritz is fabricating note, or portions of his note, and who knows who wrote those notes? We don't know who wrote those notes. We have no idea who wrote those notes. Go one step further, and look, the most important thing to realize about the murder of Oswald, the most important thing to realize is you can't bring Oswald down the stairs into the basement until Jack Ruby is in place. That's it. Jesse Curry, Chief Curry, told news reporters the day before, if you'll come at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, I think you'll be able to see what you need to see. And Curry thought that Fritz would be done interrogating Oswald by 10 o'clock. And Fritz went in there. He's not finished yet. Okay. And Captain Fritz continued to question Oswald about every little unimportant thing for the next hour and 20 minutes. Why? Because Ruby was not in place. Ruby stops by the Western Union and sends 25 hours to Karen Carlin Bennett in Fort Worth. He does that to establish his alibi. He can't be stalking Oswald. He was. But if he's stalking Oswald, that's premeditation. He's going to die for that. So he wants to do just a random thing. So he's just, you know, sends Carlin money. He just happens to see these people down the street. He just wanders down there. He just happens to have a gun in his pocket. He just happens to slip by the police and shoot Oswald. Well, now, there's one thing that I want to emphasize. Sergeant Dean was in charge of the security in the basement. And Dean had people look everywhere in the basement at 9 o'clock in the morning. Okay, fine. About 10 o'clock, he stations two people, one person at the Main Street entrance ramp and the Commerce Street ramp. Roy Vaughn was at the main entrance. I forget the guy's name at the other entrance, Commerce Street. And then he's got a Sergeant Brock and Worley. I think it's Worley. And these two guys are standing near the elevators in the parking area of the basement. And this is underneath the annex building. It's not underneath the police department. It's underneath the annex building that was built in 1956. So the police parked their cars. Now, there's a door in that, right in the middle of that parking area. You cannot open that door from the parking garage. It's a one-way door, just like a movie theater door. A fire escape. There's a fire. You go to the door, you push the latch, it opens. But from the outside of the movie theater, you can't open the door. So that's what you had here. And what you got is Jack Ruby going to the Western Union, walking to the back of the annex building. And after he gets in the back of the annex building, the door just happened to be open. He walks about 45 feet to the stairway. He goes down the stairway, opens the door, and there's a police officer right there. Who's the police officer? Well, it turns out that Brock and Worley were sent to traffic duty. Leave your posts in the basement and go to traffic duty. And then there was one reserve officer left in the parking area. He's unnamed. I'm 99% sure that was Croy. And why do I say it was Croy? Because Croy was standing probably 10 or 15 feet from that door. Jack Ruby walks down that stairway, opens the door, and there's policeman Croy. And Croy walks with Ruby. Croy goes up the ramp. Ruby goes through the railing. And in less than 1 minute, minute and a half, Croy is standing next to Ruby, shoulder to shoulder, waiting for Oswald to appear. And then he shoots Oswald. That's why I think it was Croy. Now, Burt Griffin, Warren Commission Attorney Burt Griffin, figured most of this out in 1964. He was convinced, Burt Griffin was convinced that Patrick Dean had something to do with Ruby coming down the annex stairs in the parking lot. And he's right. He was pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. And Sergeant Dean just went berserk. I mean, he went just crazy. So he was told to talk to the city attorney. The city attorney told him to talk to the district attorney, Henry Wade. Henry Wade then called President Johnson at his ranch and said this fellow attorney, Burt Griffin, was harassing Patrick Dean. So a short while later, the attorney general of Texas, Wagner Carr, he and Dean, Sergeant Dean, fly to Washington, D.C. and have a meeting with Chief Justice Earl Warren. The next day, Burt Griffin was recalled from Dallas to Washington, D.C., and all of the investigation of the Dallas Police Department stopped. My point is, Burt Griffin figured this out correctly in 1964. the House Select Committee basically figured out the same thing and wrote in their report their findings. And they found it strange that Ruby could get into the basement. They thought he had to have been assisted by someone. They thought it strange that officers were removed and sent to traffic duty and that the basement was basically unguarded. And they concluded that they thought Ruby had assistance getting into the basement. Anyway, all I did really was follow what Bert Griffin had done. Although I didn't know about Bert Griffin until I got into this. And the only thing I went one step further is I just believe that Sergeant Croy and Westbrook were into this whole thing as a team. They may have had one or two other people involved, but I don't know who that would be. I think Captain Fritz was involved somehow. Well, in my mind, no question about it, in the arranged murder of Oswald. Patrick Dean, I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know. So.
Well, regardless of the pre-planning, they all went along with the cover-up. Nobody spoke out.
Yes, nobody spoke out. And, you know, like I said, if people would simply focus on where in the world Oswald learned to speak Russian, fluent, perfect Russian, right Russian. I mean, that's number one. Look, in 1993, 30 years ago, I gave my first talk, maybe it's 92. I gave my first talk at one of those conventions in Texas, in Dallas. And my closing statement was very simple. If you will understand who Lee Oswald was and who created him, then you'll know who was responsible for the assassination of President Kennedy. And I believe that to this day.
Yeah, and like you say, who created him? I mean, this is the intelligence agencies and their assets, you know, not Castro.
No, not Castro, not the mafia. No. 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 Lynn, do you have any questions?
No, I'm going to urge everyone go to your website, harveyandlee.net, and look over these videos. They may have heard the audio on Black Op Radio last year, but the videos take it to a whole other dimension. So there's six new ones.
The videos are also on YouTube.
Yeah, right. That's where the links are, yeah. But, yeah, it's just, again, more interesting work. And it isn't arguing with people who think the Warren Commission got it right. Nobody thinks the Warren Commission got it right. And otherwise, so for the researchers who are doing what you're doing, looking into it, we can agree, disagree, we can discuss, debate. And one of the things I almost always have, well, I mention when you're on, and say, listen, if you subscribe to everything John says or not, just go through the book, go through the video, listen to what you might learn, and say, I might not agree with all of it, but look at all that good work that he's done and the things he's brought forward. So that's what I appreciate out of it. Like you say, when Anita says he never spoke Russian, what are you talking about? I mean, you have to take these people into account. And like you say, you put on the left paper down and then on the right, and you look at the two, and either there's two people, or even more, but there's, you know, there's just so many instances that you have found of duplicate sets of somebody's ordering Jeeps here, somebody's in Atsugi, you know, somebody's, it's just, it's astounding.
Well, Lynn, look, the first thing that I found out, and I don't want to make this, you know, conversation extended by any means, but the first thing I found out, I had some questions about San Saba in Benbrook. The Warren Commission never looked at the land records for Tarrant County.
Now, can you just, for people who don't know what that is, just give me a quick definition.
Oh, San Saba is a street in the town of Benbrook in the county of Tarrant, which is adjacent to Fort Worth. Now, this is, look, what I'm going to tell you is fact. Okay, it's fact. It's going to be hard for you to accept, understand, believe, whatever. I'm going to tell you what the records show. In July 1947, Marguerite Clavery Ekdahl is living at 1505 8th Avenue in Fort Worth. All right. Lee's going to Lily Clayton Elementary School. Now, she buys this house at 101 San Saba in Benbrook. There's a neighbor that lives across the street. They were building their house, and that was Georgia Bell and her husband. Now, I'll talk about Georgia later, but Georgia built that house with her husband in 1947. And in 1997-98, Jack White and I visited Georgia Bell several times and met with her. Same house. Okay. Now, Marguerite Clavery Ekdahl bought that house, July 1947. When I talked to Georgia Bell, I introduced myself and showed her an FBI report. And she looked at that FBI report and she said, wait a minute, they didn't live there in 1948, which is what the FBI report says. She said, they lived there in 1947. I told them 1947. I said, Georgia, I mean, she was 83 years old at that time. Georgia, how can you be so sure it was 1947? Because Walter and I were building, Walter was her husband. Walter and I were building this house when they moved in across the street. We're just finishing our house. Oh, okay. Well, that's pretty good memory. So who lived across the street? Mrs. Oswald. Now, I have a picture of Marguerite and Ekdahl when they were married. And I showed that picture to Georgia Bell. I also showed Georgia Bell the picture of Marguerite Oswald working at Clyde Campbell Men's Store in 1957, Christmas time. And she looked at both of those. She said, I don't know who that is. Then I showed her the picture of the short, heavyset Marguerite Oswald, which is the fake Marguerite Oswald. The one we all know is not the real Marguerite Oswald at all, not even close. And she says, that's her, short and fat, just like I remember her. Now, that's not John Armstrong saying that. That's her neighbor who lived across the street from Georgia Bell. And she had one small son. That was all. They lived there from June of 1947 to Thanksgiving time, around 1947. And Marguerite did not drive a car. She sometimes worked as a practical nurse, wore a white nurse's uniform. That was it. But that was it. And then, and Georgia Bell said one time, she asked her neighbor, Lucille Hubbard, to help her get some clothes and furniture. So Georgia Bell said that they drove in Lucille Hubbard's car to a house across the street from Stripling School. Wait a minute. Stripling School. And she had furniture and a lot of clothes stored in that house. Interesting. That's the same house they were living in 1954, when Robert Oswald told us that his brother, which was not his brother's, Harvey, Russian-speaking fellow, was attending Stripling Junior High, 1954. And guess who Marguerite Oswald is living the day of the assassination? The same house next to Stripling. You got Marguerite Oswald associated with that house in 1947, 1954, and 1963. Now, you tell me if that isn't just unexplainable.
Well, let's get into that at another time then.
Yeah, no, that's all I'm trying to say is that you have Harvey and the short, heavyset Marguerite in 1947 living across the street from Georgia Bell, while Marguerite Oswald and Ekdahl are living at 1505 8th Avenue in Fort Worth. That's the first sighting of the two separate mothers and the two separate Oswalds. The next time is New York City. The next time is 1954, Stripling and Beauregard. The next time is the Marines going to the same radar school. You know, it duplicates from 1947 forward. This is not duplications 3 months before the assassination, 4 months before the assassination. This is a history of these two kids going back to when they were young. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Okay, well, everyone, at harveyandlee.net, John has 6 new videos up there. So go over them. And then if you do have any questions, you can send them in to me. I'll pass them on to John, and we'll bring him up next time he's on. All right, well, Mr. Armstrong, thank you so much for sharing an hour or so with me tonight. I know sometimes we talk, and I always say, well, we got to record it. Well, we did right now, so... I think the people who tune into Black Op Radio, they're always interested, and they write me and say, thanks for having them on, and good. Well, I guess have a happy new year then, and it's been an eventful 2024, but I'll talk to you again in the near future, and...
Sounds good.
All right. So once again, thank you for sharing your time. People appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
All right. Aloha then.
Bye-bye.
Bye.